Welcome to Unceded Airwaves, brought to you by the Indigenous Collective and broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Today we're talking about the ongoing conflict on Wet'suwet'en territory, what's happened, what's still happening, and what the implications are for the future.
We're very lucky to have Chantelle Belrichard in studio with us. Chantelle is a reporter from CBC Indigenous. She also works with the UBC School of Journalism, where Steph and I are students. Chantelle was at Ginamden checkpoint when the RCMP arrived, and we're going to ask her about the experience of reporting and the ongoing conflict. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
And Cheryl Lightfoot is a professor at UBC. She teaches Indigenous Studies and Political Science. Cheryl's work focuses on Indigenous rights and self-determination on a global scale. She's also written about implementing the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, also known as UNDRIP. Thanks for being here, Cheryl.
Thanks so much.
We've been in contact with community members at Ginamden Checkpoint, and we were hoping to get someone on the phone with us, but there's still a lot going on. And the RCMP is maintaining an exclusion zone, which we'll talk about. And there's a gathering of solidarity in Smithers today, so there's just no one available. But have no fear, Autumn Schnell is going to give us her perspective and is a writer, poet, media specialist, and unceded alumni.
Hello.
And who are we? We're the Indigenous Collective. We're a volunteer-run group that brings you this hour-long show every week. I'm Steph. My ancestral name is Kwetosowet, and I'm a citizen of the Squamish Nation.
My name's Jamuna, and I am from North Vancouver, Tsleil-Waututh Territory. My mom's from Nepal, and my dad's Ukrainian, and Dene Métis from Northern Saskatchewan.
Shereen Gweezy, Autumn Schnell Vilji, Chief Jim Cooey, Janet Cooey, Jacqueline Cooey, Wade Schnell Shadeji. My name is Autumn. I am Gwich'in from Treaty 11 territory, as well as Inuvialuit, but I was born and raised in Amiskwetchewaskayagan on Treaty 6 territory, and I feel really privileged to live and learn here on unceded Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh lands. Do you want to introduce yourselves at all?
Sure, I will. Thank you. As I was introduced earlier, my name is Cheryl Lightfoot. I'm Anishinaabe. I'm from the Lake Superior Band of Ojibwe, which surrounds the Great Lake of what we call Superior, both sides of the border. I grew up primarily in Minneapolis-St. Paul, which is plural, overlapping, and sometimes contested territory between the Anishinaabe people and the Dakota Nation.
And I am Chantelle Belrichard. I live here in MST, Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh territories in Vancouver. And my background is my mother is the daughter of Dutch immigrants, and my father's family came from Treaty 6 territory just outside of Edmonton. My grandmother was from a Cree Métis community in St. Albert, Villeneuve.
Thank you so much, everyone, for all your introductions. We thought that we could begin, in case any listeners are still a little lost about what's happening, that maybe, Chantelle, you could give us some context, since you've been covering the story for some time, just about a debrief about the Wet'suwet'en's relationship with the Coastal GasLink pipeline, what led to these checkpoints, and the eventual RCMP breach of those checkpoints.
Okay, here goes the hour. So in a nutshell, the story is about a division, sort of a contrast or competing legal views between Wet'suwet'en law and Canadian law. It is difference between showing the cracks sort of in the idea of who you consult with on projects. So you have the band councils, and then you have the hereditary leadership that still very much is active and practices its own governance system for the Wet'suwet'en. And so in all of that, a company, Coastal GasLink, has seen itself as getting all the approvals it needs from the different regulators and the provincial agencies to build a pipeline from northeastern BC, so in the shale gas fields, to the coast in Kitimat. And so they're responsible for this pipeline, and another conglomerate of companies want to build a big processing facility on the coast to ship LNG overseas. So in that, they've known for quite some time that they've had some access issues. The company's just made a final investment decision on going ahead with this project in October. And so that really kicked a lot of things into action and why we're seeing this happen now. So the Unist'ot'en camp has been out on the land in Wet'suwet'en territory since 2009 is when the checkpoint was established, and then since 2010 they've really expanded their footprint on their land, which now includes this really sprawling healing center, which is a really impressive building given how remote it is on a forest service road in northern BC. So that was established strategically in the beginning around standing in the way of pipeline projects that wanted to move through their territory, and they established and sort of built up on their land and called a reoccupation of their territory. And with that, they created a checkpoint that would be similar to a border. So you drive up and you check in with people and you say, this is who I am, this is what I'd like to be doing here. And they would decide whether or not you could come in or not. And Coastal GasLink knew that they were not being given permission to go through this checkpoint for years. And when they would go, they would be told, and my understanding would be, you can't come here, we're not going to open the gate for you unless you have permission from our hereditary chiefs, because they are the people who can give you consent. And so this is where Cheryl's going to be able to talk a lot about UNDRIP stuff, because we're talking consent. And then there was an injunction filed because of this. They saw it as a last resort, saying, okay, well, maybe the courts can tell these people to move and so we can get on the territory. And in response, the Gidimden clan, which is another one of five clans in the Wet'suwet'en Nation, set up a second checkpoint sort of to show their solidarity with the Unist'ot'en. And that is where the RCMP enforcement action happened last week, because they were seen as in violation of this interim injunction order from the BC courts, and which included enforcement provisions within there for the RCMP's involvement.
Wow. That was really fast. It was not the full hour. And then, like you said, it would be an important context right off the bat to hear about UNDRIP and how that kind of plays into the situation, especially the idea of free, prior, and informed consent.
Yeah, so again, we could take another hour talking about this particular issue and how it relates to what's happening on the ground here in BC at this moment. So in terms of background, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People has been in the works for decades, but officially passed in the UN General Assembly in 2007. So it's now about 11 years old. And while Canada was an objector to it originally, they did come around a few years later to accept it, at least in principle. And then in 2016, we had a formal announcement from Minister Carolyn Bennett at the United Nations that Canada would be a full supporter and would proceed with its intent to adopt and fully implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And since then, we've had a little bit of activity on the policy front, and we've had a lot of activity on the legislative front trying to get a bill passed called Bill C-262, which would set out a framework for implementing the declaration in Canada. Meanwhile, the NDP government and the Greens together in BC have also committed to fully adopting and implementing the UN declaration in British Columbia. So one of the fundamental components of the UN Declaration is, of course, the right to free, prior, and informed consent by Indigenous peoples for projects and any other policy decisions that may impact them directly. And the Declaration is quite clear on what it means by this. Free, prior, and informed consent does come out of the fundamental human right of self-determination, which we all accept in a free, open, and democratic society, and which has been part of the UN human rights framework for many decades now, since the end of World War II. So free, prior, and informed consent is linked to self-determination, because a people is only self-determining if they have the right to give or withhold consent for anything, or if they have the ability to consent with conditions. So what the Declaration is trying to point out is that Indigenous peoples have the equal right of self-determination to all other peoples on the planet, which prior to the UN Declaration was not the case. There was a limited right of self-determination in many countries, including Canada, which liked to claim that it could infringe or limit Indigenous people's self-determination and consent by strictly passing a court order or an injunction, perhaps, or any other instrument, and that it could essentially roll over Indigenous people's right to self-determination. So the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples corrects that and actually provides an equal right of self-determination for Indigenous peoples. And free, prior, and informed consent, then, the ability to agree or disagree with something that impacts peoples, is a fundamental human right.
Just as a follow-up to that, I would like to, this also overlaps with media coverage, just about the conversation that's been happening about the so-called rule of law is a term that we've been hearing a lot, and it seems to typically be only referring to state law instead of indigenous law. So I guess I was wondering if we could talk a little bit more about actually acknowledging these other indigenous legal systems.
Do you want to take that, or do you want to start?
I mean, I guess I can give you the sense of how people on the ground are talking about that, because that's a really important thing to distinguish. Because, you know, if you look at the language used by Coastal GasLink's legal team in their court filings, it's worth pointing out that they named two individuals. So they didn't actually name, like, a hereditary group within the Wet'suwet'en. They named Frida Hewson and her partner Smogulgum, who happens to be a hereditary leader, but that's kind of besides the point. The language that is used is blockaders. You know, these blockaders are blah, 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 blah. And the injunction is sort of this idea that if you're seen in violation, then you are risk arrest from the RCMP according to, you know, whatever provisions in the criminal code or civil actions they can take against individuals, which they have. They've arrested 14 people last week, much to the upset and sort of, as the chiefs have described it, a deep traumatic experience for the people there. And then on the other side, you hear this language around how the people at the Gidimden camp and at Unist'ot'en self-identify, and they call, they're like, we're not protesting, we're not, you know, activists, we're not blockading, we're exercising our laws on our territory, we are sovereign people, these are our laws. So actually, in fact, you know, when the RCMP did show up in full force to do this enforcement, one of the things that was hurled at them was, you're trespassing, you're breaking our laws. And so it was this idea of laws being, whose laws were being broken. And on one side, it was very clear that they felt that Wet'suwet'en law was being broken, that people were being taken from their land illegally, according to principles in UNDRIP about people being forcibly removed from their territories. And so you do have two very different legal components competing. And I should also note, just while we're on the injunction, is that this is an interim injunction. So this hasn't even gone to trial yet in before the BC Supreme Court. It was an action put forth to the courts. Smogulgum and Frida Hewson, when they got that, they said, we need some more time to respond. Part of that was due to family issues, that Smogulgum's mother was on her deathbed. So they said, we need a bit more time. And the court said, okay, well, we'll give you a bit more time to prepare. January 31st is when you'll see a lot more filings come in. And Coastal GasLink's legal team said, sure, we'll give you that extra time, but hey, judge, in the meantime, can you give us this interim injunction? So that's what we have in terms of the Canadian legal system's application of this injunction.
Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I do. Thanks for that. And I think it just highlights how complex and nuanced this particular situation is. And so I want to parse out a couple different components. So we have several different kinds of law in place. And so when we talk about rule of law, we have to actually consider all of them, not just one. And so, yes, we do have a Canadian system. We have the laws of BC, and we have the possibility of RCMP enforcement of judicial orders. That is at one level correct. We have, in the indigenous communities, we have two sets of governance that are operating simultaneously. And sometimes those two systems work together, and sometimes they're in conflict, and sometimes they work together in part and disagree in part. And let me just back up a little bit. So we have, on the one hand, what we call elected band councils. So those are the chief and council that are elected in democratic voting elections on a reserve. And so those chiefs and council under the Indian Act are charged with governance and management of reserve territories. That's generally speaking within the area we call Canada, fairly small bits of territory that those chiefs and councils are charged with jurisdiction over. At the same time, and sometimes overlapping with that, is a system of traditional governance, or what we're calling hereditary leadership, although there are many different names for this as we go across the continent. And the hereditary leaders have been charged with governance. I think we can think of it more as guardianship over a wide swath of territory for millennia. And the traditions and the governance styles come down generation to generation for millennia, and and are tied intrinsically to those territories in a cultural and a spiritual and a political sense, a governance sense. And certainly in this particular case, those hereditary structures have been existing continuously for millennia alongside the imposition of the Indian Act. And I say imposition because, of course, when we're talking about British Columbia, there are no treaties. These lands were never given up by the peoples. And so there is, in the not-so-distant past, a direct imposition of the Canadian Indian Act onto peoples who never consented to it. So that's one big piece of this puzzle. And then also in all of this is... rule of law also means the international human rights laws. And again, we go back to the UN Declaration and what it expects, and also Canada's agreement to that. So that forms a particular set of international expectations. And so we have two to three different systems at play here, which we could all judge as a standard of rule of law. And also, and I just want to add this, one of the elements of the UN Declaration and the human rights standards is that when we come up to one of these situations where the answers are unclear and we have conflicts between different players, the intention is not to use forcible police actions or remove people from territory, but to find a negotiating framework, an impartial framework, so that these sorts of conflicts and confusions and contradictions can be worked out in a mutually respectful manner. So that's also one of the articles in the Declaration that Canada has signed on to.
Yeah, one of the things you bring up about the police presence that showed up and the force of presence, and one of the things that I've heard kind of their rebuttal to that is that it was the location that, you know, demanded that kind of presence. And I'm wondering, Chantel, can you talk a little bit more about, like, exactly, like, where is this situated? You said it's down a forestry road, but, like, how remote is this location? And what was the police presence in your observation? What did it feel like and look like to you?
The location of the Gidimden camp, which is where I spent the most time, just given everything that was going on, is 44 kilometers down a Forest Service road outside of Houston, B.C. So Houston's already pretty small. Their detachment, I could appreciate, would not have the capacity to move in and do this type of enforcement order. Yeah, you turn off Highway 16 right before you get into town, and you go 27 kilometers down one way, and then you turn right, and then you lose cell service about 10 kilometers down this road. So it's remote for sure, and you know, you're outside of a service range, and but there's a lot of activity that's happening there because it is a very active logging road. So you see there's a lot of use from the forestry industry, and then also just from Wet'suwet'en people who are going out and practicing whatever it is that they see fit on the land, whether that's hunting or trapping. There people were hunting and trapping when we were out there. So yeah, remote, but very much a place that's very alive in terms of people's practices on that land. So the RCMP presence was, there were people brought in from detachments all over. I know I spoke to people personally who were there from the North Shore. I booked into this hotel in Houston, and it was me and I think all the other rooms were RCMP, and they had booked a block. There was a very chatty man at the front desk of this this motel, and so he was really excited to show me all of the highlighted spots on this sheet, showing me all of the rooms the RCMP had booked for a whole month and how he was going to get paid regardless of if they stay or not. So he was quite excited, and it also gave me a sense of how the RCMP were approaching this, in the sense that you don't book a block of rooms for a month unless you think you may need them. And it was when they did show up, they had shown up more than once, but when it was clear that, you know, they weren't going to come to some agreement to just open these gates and allow this company through, they came back in much fuller force. The first sign was that a helicopter was flying overhead. There was a lot of nervous energy. People had they described it as fortifying where the gate was and putting a lot of different obstructions in the way, and described it as a setting up to protect themselves from the RCMP's arrival. One of the things I think alarmed a lot of people who saw the images from that was the people who were part of this tactical team. I think they're the ERT members, who looked quite militarized. You know, they're wearing these like green helmets and head-to-toe green outfits, different from, you know, the navy blue that the other members were in, and they were carrying assault rifles over their shoulders. And so just that presence, you know, the helicopter flew over, then you see a convoy of vehicles show up around this corner, and a bunch of people getting out and huddling far away. You see this like little black blob in the distance, and people inside the checkpoint started attaching themselves to things and preparing to sort of dig in. The air horn went off to sort of alert everybody at the camp that they had arrived, and it sort of escalated from there. There were weird moments of like back and forth, and then a bit of quiet where the RCMP would sort of stop and appear to be strategizing amongst themselves of like what their next moves were in terms of getting over the gate, or, you know, can't go over, gotta go on, whatever that was. They were chopping off the barbed wire and really trying to get a sense of how to do that enforcement. But people were deeply upset. There were people screaming this idea of like, you're trespassing, you don't have to do this, we love you. There were young men, you know, who look like they're like, I don't know, tough guys, like tough guy, but, you know, who were just like just sobbing, which is alarming, you know, to look, having spent some time with these people, just to see how deeply emotional and distressing it was for people. And I know that there have been a lot of controversy about what that looks like in terms of overly aggressive on the part of people at the camp, and saying that it was traumatic, and then the RCMP describing them as being in a challenging situation in which they were experiencing assaultive behavior, I think was the term that was used. But in the end, you know, no one was seriously physically injured, but the chiefs and the people I saw, it was clear that sort of emotional injury was perhaps, you know, worse, because it tied into so many other things in the history, you know, missing and murdered women, residential schools, the role the RCMP took in taking children away from their families, the RCMP's role in enforcing potlatch ban and coming into the feast halls and taking things away from people or punishing them for practicing their culture and being who they are. So that history, everybody's carrying that in that camp, and it's top of mind. And some of these people, you know, have family members who've gone missing or been murdered. And so when they see the RCMP show up in that way, it shows them, you know, they're like, they feel like they're being violated, and at the same time have this history of feeling like, okay, once again, the RCMP are showing up for someone else's agenda and not here to protect us. So I'd say that's kind of how it'd sum up the RCMP actions there, and probably why it struck such a chord internationally, because we've seen this time and time again in things like OCA and Standing Rock, and so this is kind of a bit of history repeating itself in terms of the optics of the situation.
I would love to bring Autumn into the conversation, because I feel like you'll have a lot to say about this specifically. First, like Chantal said, the experience of seeing those images when you're not there, and also how that relates to your community here and your community at home, like what went through your mind when you first saw all of this happening.
I think that's a really hard question, because I think overwhelmed would be the feeling. Like, I was feeling a lot of emotions towards, like, in relation with the people, but also like kind of connecting it to my homeland and thinking about what happened to my homeland when the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline inquiry was happening. And like, I feel like we were really lucky because the judge ended up siding with us, but I know that it could have easily gone the other way as well. But I think I felt a lot of compassion for the people as well, because I know some of the people who were arrested, and some of my friends are really good friends with other people who were arrested, and one of my friends let somebody borrow her car to drive it to Houston to bring a deer there. And like, I think that it's really deep, because even though I'm not directly connected to it, I think we all are at least somewhat connected to it, feeling this from our own homelands, our family and friends, or like imagining what the RCMP would have been like to like my grandma, and knowing that these people could be somebody's grandma one day. I don't know. I think it's really hard. I feel way less, not necessarily educated, but less prepared for this conversation than both of you. But I think, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think the impact is a really big part of this conversation. It's a lot of people are feeling affected, even though, you know, we're not all from that area. And Chantal, you're telling me, you're just mentioning that a lot of people have come from other territories. And so I'm wondering if you could speak just a little more to that, you know, how people, like, why, what are some of the reasons people are saying they're coming or traveling from far, and what are some places you've heard people coming from?
Yeah, there are people from all over, you know, the different Wet'suwet'en communities, obviously. A lot of Gitxsan relatives and friends, which, you know, there's a lot of people who are, you know, have relatives on in these territories. So there was a lot of sort of showing of solidarity in that sense among neighboring nations. And then you saw people from Six Nations that came out, from Mi'kmaq territory. And that one was really interesting, actually, the young woman who came out from Halifax. Rebecca, she, you know, she said explicitly she came basically to return a favor. You know, she, there was a Wet'suwet'en woman who had been living in her territory for some time who stood side by side with her to stand up against LNG projects in her territory, and they had sort of been on the front lines together. And she told me as soon as this woman reached out and said, you know, we need support for this action and to be in Gitumden. She said she, without hesitation, just dropped everything, jumped like in her life, and was like, I'm going and I'll stay as long as I need to. And so there's a lot of this sort of idea of returning favors for each other, people who had been at Standing Rock. And I think you saw that again today with the hereditary chiefs and the leadership that came together in Smithers once again to talk about, you know, thanking the hereditary leadership who were showing up at Lilu Island to stand in solidarity with them then when they were standing up against LNG. And so there's quite a network of people in there. And then, I mean, I know it's easy to talk about that because it was so front and center. But I keep wanting to remind myself and other people that, you know, we've only heard from people who were on the front lines and the really vocal opponents. And I do know that there are Wet'suwet'en people who have contracts as you know, people with their own companies that are going to stand to benefit economically from this and probably welcome opportunity. And there are economic benefits that the band councils are looking to receive. And so that's another piece of this puzzle that's really complex and is causing a lot of hurt and a lot of divisions within the Wet'suwet'en themselves.
Before moving on, we will take a brief break. And due to special request, we're going to listen to I Pity the Country by Willie Dunn. So we'll be right back.
All I wanted was more cocaine. More cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
Three women, dressed in lingerie, were hanging from the ceiling on meat hooks. In an adjacent room, a man was in bed with two deceased females, also wearing lingerie. He positioned their arms in a sexy embrace. Down the hall, a man holding a chainsaw stood over the motionless body of a sixth woman, lying on a table covered in plastic. These are scenes from a popular music video by a Grammy Award-winning artist. If we want violence against women to stop, shouldn't we stop treating it like entertainment? Join the conversation at hashtag not okay.
There's only one way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again. Donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out. Free towing or pickup of your old vehicle, a tax-deductible receipt, and a super easy process. Online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights froze me. In jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they palm me. They're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me. Materialists test me. Pollution, it chokes me. Movies, they joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life, it jades me. Hudson Bay fleece me, hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
Welcome back to Unceded Airwaves. It's 2:34, and just to continue our conversation, Cheryl, could you speak a little bit more about what the implications of this international spotlight is?
Yeah, just picking up from our conversation before the break, I think when we talk about the solidarity that's been building both across Canada in just about every urban area and some smaller towns too, I've seen. We've had rallies. We've had lots of people upset with what has happened. I've also seen it spread internationally. I've seen a number of other Indigenous movements from around the world join into the conversation, as well as environmental movements and some other allied movements. And I think that's both a reflection of a few things that have happened globally in recent decades, and also an indication of opportunity space. So I think, the indigenous movement has been organizing internationally for a number of decades, and things like cell phones and social media more recently have made that even easier to communicate and send things out in real time. And I think we saw that a couple years ago with the Standing Rock resistance down with the Dakota Access Pipeline issue, that one protest movement in a small and remote area of one country can immediately go global and become an object of outrage for people all over the world. And those peoples sometimes and very often share similar histories of colonialism and state oppression, or even police action like we have seen. So maybe it was Oka in 1990, or maybe it was the Alta Dam crisis in Norway in about the same in the 1980s. Maybe it was Standing Rock. But there are hundreds of cases literally from around the globe where people are seeing themselves in this struggle and have that shared experience and that shared legacy. So I think there is a common global resistance to that old style of colonialism and top-down control. Now, I think the opportunity space is that looking forward, all of these movements are pushing towards change. And I think giving that sort of global vision to a moment where we can see that there's a need for some kind of change is a real opportunity space. And it does build alliance with other allied movements and potential support.
Can I ask you a question in that, in terms of the international attention? Because one of the things that I find is really challenging journalistically, you know, is that we are expected to provide a balanced perspective on these things. But also, and maybe curious where you see the line between balance and maybe creating false equivalencies in order to serve some type of purpose that all sides are heard.
Yeah, that is, it's something that we always hope to be attentive to, because, again, there are dual purposes. So indigenous peoples in most countries are, in population terms, a very small minority, often one that doesn't carry a great deal of political or financial power. And so one of the ways that you can build support for your cause is through social media and solidarity building movements. So we want to support that on the one hand. At the same time, we also want to respect what the chiefs and the hereditary leaders want. And so we have to be cognizant of what the people in that particular context, in that particular location, with their sets of histories, want. And so we have to be a little bit cautious in how we build solidarities, because we want to make sure that they're accurate and that they're in line with the conditions on the ground in those particular contexts and histories. And that can be a challenge in the social media world as things go viral overnight and people get very excited and outraged. But I just have to ask that as people are wanting to build solidarity, that they ask first, what do the chiefs want?
Also, Autumn, I wanted to ask you another question.
Okay.
Since you've also taken part in solidarity actions for a lot of indigenous issues, I know especially when you were the leader of the show last year, like that was a big part of it. And so what are some expressions of solidarity that you've noticed within your own community, or what kind of thing would you like to see?
I don't know about what I would like to see, because I think that it's always changing and it depends a lot. But I know that in the past, specifically with Uni Stoughton, just like retweeting things on Twitter, getting visibility. I know I follow Chantel Bell Richard, who's here. And you were my main source in finding out information, because nowhere else was really keeping up day-to-day. So I remember sitting in one of my three-hour classes, and I don't think I paid attention at all in that class, like, whatsoever. And I was just getting updates on the camps and what was happening. And that was the day that the RCMP followed through with the government, or with the, yeah, government orders. So that was a big one. Also, I think going out to rallies and kind of taking part in things like that this year, after, I think it was the day after that, my class was canceled, and we were able to go to the rally. It wasn't forced attendance, although I probably should have been for an FNIS class. But I know that I partook in that, and that felt really powerful, just hearing people's perspectives who were on the ground, or hearing other chiefs' perspectives who were wanted to show support but didn't really know how to, or hearing like other nations. And there were people who were like Gitxsan and Squamish, and like it was just like a really solid way of unifying. And I think that being able to partake in things like that has changed my perspectives a lot. Not necessarily that they were opposed to it, but it improved them. I also think talking about things in class is a big one, especially for university students. I remember last year after the Colton Bushi and Tina Fontaine events happened, we didn't talk about any of the events in any of my classes. And that felt really upsetting, because how are we supposed to collectivize and share ideas without having some sort of dialogue? So I hosted something similar to that on the show with a few of the other collective members last year. And I think that it was one of the most powerful ways for me to feel less alone, for me to feel supported, for me to feel like I'm capable of giving other people support. So I don't know if that's necessarily an answer towards looking in the future, but that's what's helped me personally in the past. And I think that that's other ways. If anybody else has any ideas, you can tweet us at Unseated Airwaves. But yeah, that's how I have felt solidarity in the past, and have felt like I was capable of giving solidarity despite being trapped in an institution that won't let you leave for more than 3 days. So,
Cheryl, I'm wondering if you could speak to how the TRC plays into this.
Yes, thank you. I think I would like to situate that in terms of expectations that have also been building. So in addition to the political acts of recent governments, both in Ottawa and in Victoria, where newly elected governments have promised to adopt and implement the declaration, we do have something in this country that's more longstanding, that is nonpartisan, or I should say not nonpartisan, it's all partisan in this country, and that is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which, if we're not familiar with it, let me just say that that was a truth commission that was set, that came about through the legal settlement over the largest class action suit that's ever been filed in Canada, the residential school survivors against that really more than century-long policy of residential schools. And the Truth Commission had worked between 2009 and 2015 to both find out the truth and collect statements and collect documents on the history of residential schools, but also, and crucially just as important, to set out a new framework and a new pathway for a post-TRC future in this country. And so in 2015, when they issued their final report, along with that were 94 calls to action. And these calls are specifically intended to deal with the legacy effects of the policy in this country, but also to set us out on a new form of governance and a new form of society. And the TRC was very clear in Call to Action 43 that the framework for that new society was to be the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And it specifically called for the full adoption and implementation of that document, not just in the federal government or in the provincial governments, but in municipal governments, in institutions like universities, in civil society, in all facets, our educational systems. They've called for it to become the foundation of, and I know this is a highly contested word, reconciliation in this country, but what they mean by that was setting out a new future and a new form of governance and a new society, not so different from other post-conflict societies where we've seen TRCs like South Africa or Guatemala. Their intention was to make a clear demarcation between the old style of top-down hierarchical colonialism and a new future, which would be grounded in better relations between Indigenous peoples and everyone else.
And not that it's your responsibility to decide how that could play out, but how can you go about beginning to go from federal to provincial to municipal level and actually completely overhaul like all these systems that are not at not at all in keeping with Andrew.
Obviously, it's a mammoth project, and it will take us all a huge time commitment, energy commitment, and a lot of political will to do it. And it's certainly not going to be anything that's a gently upward progression. We're going to see lots of fits and starts because the colonial framework has been here for a very long time, and it is embedded in our political systems, our economic systems, our social systems, and so trying to redo that and create something new is a massive project that will require many, many people over many years to actually get right. And truthfully, some of the questions that that presents to us in the contemporary period are some of the biggest policy and law questions of our time. So looking forward, this particular story has shown us in real time and right in our faces that we don't have a good idea of what free, prior, and informed consent means. We don't yet know how we get it, how we know when we have it, and when we come up in difficulties, how we resolve those questions. This has been one of the biggest examples of that failure so far that we have. So our responsibility is to start real meaningful conversations and in-depth conversations about how could we be doing this better. What are people's ideas about getting free, prior, and informed consent? So how do we know when we've consulted and gotten the consent of both an elected band council, but also the hereditary leadership and the other local communities? How do we know when all of those groups and those constituencies have had their voices heard and have let us know whether they have given consent or not? Because the current systems are dismally failing.
To go back to you, Chantal, I'm just thinking again about, you know, like Cheryl has pages and pages to be able to explore these really complex issues through academia. And then you have maybe max 800 words to give this kind of context. And I've even seen a lot of misconceptions in the comment sections online about, for example, that that I saw someone say that the hereditary chiefs had like kept it secret that they were opposed to the project till the last minute and this kind of thing. So how do you go about disseminating this kind of misinformation?
You know, I think the big challenge in my role specifically is that working for the public broadcaster requires putting things into context in a way that some of my coworkers talked about, you know, like somebody who's like never heard of the Wet'suwet'en or whatever, who's just kind of like going about their business in wherever that may be, somewhere on the other side of Canada. And sort of the idea that we are a public broadcaster at CBC, but how do you define the public? There's so many publics in this country. So, like, you know, you talk about, like, Cheryl sat here, and among people here, obviously, like you say, TRC, there's all this shorthand that people know right away. So when I'm out in the field and get him down talking to people who are using the shorthand, like, yeah, I went to res school, I was scooped, you know, all of these different things that they talk about, like, I know what that means, but if I'm going to put that in a quote, in a story, then I have editors who are like, but like, wait, hold on a second. Like, there's just so much context. So then you kind of avoid using some of these really insightful moments that you experience, which I think is why Twitter was a really great tool to be able to use in the field, because I know there is a very active audience online that has a very different understanding of these things. So I can just be firing things off shorthand and people are going to get it. And then distilling it down for a general audience who won't know some of that shorthand and trying to still try to accurately capture sort of the heart of what's going on is incredibly challenging. And there's always incredibly important context that's not that doesn't end up in the story, and people will point that out and be critical of that. And I'm okay with being criticized, but it's yeah, it's without a doubt a huge challenge journalistically to be able to communicate to the many publics of this country who have different understandings and hankerings for information.
I think one question that comes up for me, just to clear it up, just because you mentioned it in the comments section, but what is the relationship between the band chiefs and the hereditary chiefs? Just so whoever would like to answer that.
Are you asking a formal institutional relationship or what we know about this particular case and their internal relationship with one another.
Well, I guess about this particular case, and you know, I know they have said some things in the media, but could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, in this particular case, from what I know, and I haven't been there personally on the ground, and I haven't spoken to the actual individuals involved, so this is strictly by hearsay. Let me just preface it that way. My understanding is that the elected chief and council has signed a benefit impact and benefit agreement with the company, and that is a confidential agreement. That means, unfortunately, I believe it's so confidential it hasn't been shared with the hereditary leadership, to the best of my knowledge. And that is a clear breakdown in a consent process internally. And that is, I think, one of the other issues that we need to be honest about, is that this isn't strictly a matter of the company not getting free prior and informed consent. They thought, under their best estimate, that they had it. But the company apparently, and certainly the judge issuing the injunction, is not sensitive to the fact that there are other governance structures simultaneous and parallel to the elected band chief and council. Now, what the actual structure is between a hereditary leadership and a band council is an internal matter, and it's up to each indigenous nation to decide what that looks like and how they want that to function. And I think it's fair to say, in this particular case, it also hasn't functioned very well. So we have some work to do in that area, and that's on the part of indigenous nations. We need to set up systems and procedures and structures of consent making that get to that point in a better way. Similarly, I would encourage the corporations and the governments involved not to just go for elected band council consent. To add that, I believe they should be doing consent processes better in the future as well. So they should ask a band council if they've consulted with their hereditary leadership. They should try to make sure that that's part of the equation. And I think that's one of the big lessons moving forward, is that until we know that we have that situation, and that that if we have a conflict or a difference of agreement between the two styles of leadership, we may end up in one of these situations again. And so what I look at is, how can we avoid this in the future?
Yeah, on that note, just looking forward, you know, how can we continue to keep this international attention, or how can we use this situation to leverage Indigenous rights into the future?
I think it's a key case of how we can start rethinking how we've been doing governance in this country and every other country that with Indigenous peoples. And I think it gives the principles of the Declaration a front row seat on the world stage right now, because we all are forced to ask these really deep and difficult questions that will take us into the future of a new style of society. And how do we get nation to nation? What do we mean by nation to nation? Whose nation, and how are we building this? And what kind of structures and systems and procedures can we design in this country that will better adhere to the UN Declaration? Because certainly we're not there yet. And what kinds of new relationships, and how are we going to do that? We're rethinking everything that we have previously known. And that, again, is a formidable challenge in front of all of us.
And Chantal, specifically sort of media-wise, sometimes media can tend to zoom in on like physical conflict, for example, like the checkpoint being breached, and then maybe move on when it just is stuck in all these specifics that maybe not everyone wants to read about. So once again, how do you keep this kind of story, I guess, being covered?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think there are different platforms and ways, like this show being like something that's much after the fact, that we're able to have a more fulsome conversation with the observations and expertise of different guests who can sort of bring their perspective on this and where your curiosities lies, you know, after now the dust has settled a bit. So I think having these conversations, I mean, I know that I would really love to talk to other people in terms of what were the specifics around these benefit agreements, and how were those decisions made, and how are people feeling about it now because of how much division there is. I mean, I know that one of the previous elected leaders in one of the Wet'suwet'en bands has been quite vocal on Twitter and saying how, you know, there was this big meeting today and everyone came together. well, not everyone, these different leaders were brought together, but saying, you know, we really need to have reconciliation with our own nation right now and with our, between our elected leadership and our hereditary leadership, because, yeah, we talk about them like they're these different things, and they very much are, but at the same time, these are, this is the same soup of people, of humans. They're related. They're the people who are elected chiefs are members of clans and house groups, and, you know, people in the hereditary office are band members of different bands, and so I think that also maintaining that sensitivity to know that while these things become flashpoints, that there's a lot of deep hurt that's also playing out, and to be able to navigate that in a sensitive way that maybe illustrates it journalistically, it's hard to know if that's really valuable to anybody at this point. And then also just kind of following the puck a bit with looking to see what happens in some of these court proceedings. And I mean, there's a lot of, this is often a really good time where you can dive in and do different analysis type of longer pieces, explainers around people who maybe have tuning in a bit, but are kind of like, oh, like, so what is the Wet'suwet'en governance structure among their hereditary leaders, and spelling that out, and looking at some of the nuts and bolts that get lost when you're just like in a flurry of tweets of like, this is happening right now.
All right. Thank you, Chantal, Cheryl, and Autumn, all for being here with us. Really appreciate all of your insight and explaining the significance of all this in this ongoing situation.
And that's it for our episode of Unceded Airwaves, brought to you by the Indigenous Collective. We hope you enjoyed it and that you keep your eye on the ongoing occupation of Wet'suwet'en territory. Marcy Cho for listening, and take care.